I did bring some poems from the first part of the workshop to read, so that those people will be represented here. They were sorry they couldn't keep it going. And there's some exercises that are over here on the table. And two of those are from the first part and two are from today. And the subtitle of this workshop is Rooting Out the Meanings of Ordinary Events. So as we introduce ourselves, I'd kind of like you to think of a kind of ordinary event in your life that could be the stuff of poems for you.
I have, is that the same thing?
Yes.
Oh, I'd already given her.
Oh, she had a full set?
Yeah, I think so.
And I was jotting down some ordinary events here that could be very good sources of poems. One very obvious one is the family moments here, the relatedness of the families that get together here, especially during this grandchildren week coming up. Hikes, the Holden rhythm, you get into a kind of a rhythm, you know, maybe some favorite part of that rhythm of the day. Just sitting down and thinking, having a chance to sit down and reflect. It's an ordinary event, but it's a very important one to people today because they don't have time to do that at home. Separation from family by any means. We've had a singles week this week. A lot of people here are single parents. The separation of any kind is a wonderful way to remember and celebrate a person you're separated from in the past or present time. Just being struck with seeing something and saying or thinking, wow, look around, and like, you know, a person who had just come here from living in Thailand for a number of years, and she said she kind of laughed about it later, but the first deer that she saw, she thought it was really unusual, you know, and she was just struck with this deer, and then she realized that they're so kind of commonplace, you know, after being here a while. And she was kind of thought that was embarrassing that she'd written this poem about seeing this deer, but it's a beautiful poem like that, and I'll read that. But I'd like to kind of go around and ask you about some ordinary events that might be part of this kind of relaxed kind of event writing, ordinary event writing that you could do this week if you wanted, and kind of go in a circle and start with you for your needs.
Well, I do have grandchildren here, and we came on the train together, and just having this 6-year-old, you know, come and knock on our door, and she brings a book along. You know, it's just so exciting. We don't live close to this family, so to have her want to come and be with us. So just moments with those children. Today we walked on this little path, and I was just struck with how green the ferns are and the sound of that water. Yesterday we went to 10 Mile Creek, and how you climb and get all hot, and then when you get there to the falls, it's just nice and cool. I've done that many times, and that coolness is always there.
Did you say your name?
No. Shirley Anderson.
Shirley.
From Minnesota, Redwood Falls, Minnesota.
Is that in the northern part of the state?
No, it's southwestern. They don't have any mountains there.
I heard a mother say to her kids this morning, because they were kind of whining, saying, oh, we always have to go on a hike. And she said, well, wait till we get back to Minnesota and you'll wish that we had the mountains again because it's flat there.
Okay. I'm Margaret Stevenson from Cambridge, Wisconsin. We don't have mountains either. First, when you were talking, I thought of just the beauty of the place. And then I thought of the post office, anticipating letters, cards, writing letters and cards. I like to do that. Sort of an ordinary.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not. It's
but exciting.
It isn't. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And where are you from?
Cambridge, Wisconsin.
Oh, you said that. Cambridge, Wisconsin?
Near Madison, 20 miles from Madison.
My daughter-in-law's mother lives near Cambridge.
Near Cambridge? What town?
Well, I think Cambridge is her address.
Oh, her name is
Hazel Rux is the last name.
Rux.
So it's a very, very small town. Mm-hmm.
They live in the country.
Yeah, I know where the Rux is, but I don't know Hazel.
Do you know her husband, Will?
Mm-hmm.
Rux.
Name is familiar.
Are you related to a Betty Cyrusson who was here?
No, not Betty. I am related to Stan Cyrusson, who's on the board.
Oh,
my son.
Okay. Oh, my name is Mike Buettner, and I'm Margaret's husband, and I through her, I've also cultivated an interest in poetry. But I'm a fledgling poet. I don't pretend I know a whole lot. And
he's written a lot of fiction.
Yeah. But
you mean fiction stories?
Yeah. But I think this place, so much of it depends on timing. Margaret is saying today is the day where people are moving out and moving in, so it's probably a different kind of a time than the beginning of the week where you had them on their weekly cycle, you know, because it sort of works on a weekly routine, doesn't it? I mean, you've probably been here a lot, so. And there's so many changes, that's what I think about when I go here. For example, in the dining room, they don't have the little pamphlets anymore to sing out of, and they don't sing songs, they have little pamphlets to sing music out of, too. And the trees are gone, you know.
And we don't have that.
Mm-hmm. And,
no coffee break scheduled. Do they have coffee break in the morning?
Yeah, or
they
ring the bell.
At 10 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But did you see they're working around?
Well, that's been, yeah, it's been disappointing because that area was always a very wonderful place to mingle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to interrupt
them. So where do they have it now?
It's still there, but people just had to work around, you know, work around the guests, and the guests have had to drink coffee around the workers.
They had it right behind the kitchen today. They had coffee and cold pizza.
Oh. Yeah, but the staff sort of jealously guard their space that they've always had traditionally behind the kitchen, you know. And so that would be sort of where the guests would mingle now, but they, you know, it's still territory.
Change is a very good source.
Yeah, I think change is what, if I write anything today, is what I would, because when you think of religion, you don't think of change, but religion really is in change, in coping with the change. You know? And to me, that suggests a theme, you know, the uprootedness here, the transition between directors and the lack of orderliness in some cases. I mean, the schedule's been kind of spontaneous this week, you know, a lot of hit and miss sort of things to some degree, you know, and which I'm not used to, you know, but it's because I've been here when it's stable. Mm-hmm. But this is very much part of it, too, this change.
That's a part of life.
That's
change.
A part of life.
Yeah.
Change.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to read poems that I've gathered up this week, and I told the children I was going to do this, read to the big people. I went down to Narnia So I'll read one or two of the little tiny kids' poems. It was just a delight for me to work with down there. And I, on the way, picked up some pieces of like bark and moss and things like that on the trail down by the creek. And they got to choose a, you know, what they wanted to write about and describe. And I used a quote by William Stafford, who's a very wonderful poet, who's been a teacher of mine. The writer's, and this isn't quoting him exactly, the writer's way is to gather and look at little pieces along the roads. So it's really exciting for me to think about combining William Stafford and his writing with the writing of the beavers, who were ages 4 to 6. So I'll read a couple of those. They would look at a piece of something, and the moss on the stick looks like a green frog in grass that's like sponge. The stick that has a bump on it looks like a deer's antler. The hard skin of wood is like the woods at home. The pine cone is like a cactus at the Big Red's restaurant. I like the white sticky parts of the pine cone. When my dog is always chasing a rabbit, a pine cone falls down from the tree and bumps him on the head. When bees try to sting my dog, they fly through a hole in the leaf. It is for tiny bees. He is a door dog. And someone asked this little girl, Rebecca, what a door dog was. She says, I don't know. So we came up with all kinds of answers, like, well, a door dog might be a dog that liked to go to the door a lot or come in and out. Or if you came home, it came to the door, and she said, he's in our house. And that's why he's a door dog. Then a lady wrote a short sentence poem, too, that was kind of on the spirit of what the children did. She was looking out over the railing on Building 4, and she said, her name was Ina Johnson. She's still around, actually, but she didn't come today. Two of the lesser brown squirrels encircling each other in a clockwise pattern, tying their stripes in a knot. And then we had a staff member named Cressy Rice, and she wrote 4 poems this week. I'm just going to read 2. They kind of go together. We were talking about words, and I noticed the last word of the first poem she picked up in the second poem. She's off on a 20-mile hike, but we gave a little reading, and she brought her junior minors with her to the reading. That's the first time I've ever participated in a reading where they were junior high-age kids listening. That was fun. They were about ready to go on a hike, so they had all their gear and everything, and they were listening to Cressy. But this is about taking a staff picnic, I guess, or breakfast, down to the Miners Village one morning. Breakfast buffet at the Miners Village. And she revised it with me later on, so I got my revision and went in. I straddle a houseless foundation, not knowing where or what to build from here. It is worn down, so I cannot imagine the whole structure, but I am letting myself in on who I really am in spurts of spontaneity and growing, walking in no footprints as a river follows no foot or blueprints, but contains contributories and rainfall, where sometimes she is dammed up and sits for a while, pondering how she could possibly have come from every single mountain above her, the coalition of the jagged mounds that point that way, straight up, that way, and the white blanketing makeup that smears off into her in the spring, leaving behind wrinkles and cracks, only to have a liquid voice, so clear I know that mountain is purely divine love that laughs, rejoicing in the liquid reunion and joining of hands with her sisters, rushing through my life and explaining that life is to be the highest rock capped with snow, and at the same time, the smallest pebble smoothed with water. Water. Water, rain, refreshing mist surrounding me. Mist like the awe after the first gulp of lemonade. I need the rain that teases the dusty road with only thumbtack drops, that pin only dots of receding clumps of soon-to-be wind, the way it announces its arrival with a swarm of striped air. I was telling you about the lady that wrote the poem about the deer in the reading. She said that she thought it was just really unusual to see this deer, and then she discovered they were all around. Startled, and her name is Gail Dugan. Startled, she or me? Brown pleading eyes, white switching, twitching tail. My interrupted pace, cautious, becomes how not to frighten, a foremost concern. She crossed the road, eyeing me warily, but I stood still and let the miracle of her closeness nurture my wonder. And then we did, as you'll notice in the first exercise, word kind of things, so that when she came up with this, she started with one word, and I was telling the workshop that poems are kind of like doorways, and I said when I critiqued her poem later, immediately we are invited in at the very doorway of this poem, and usually the details are so central and evocative the reader can feel and see what you have chosen to share. But she first said it, as we'll go around the room today, because we don't have silence on the tape, we did everything out loud. And the first thing she said when she was to do her writing out loud, she said, "Surprise, the sun feels good." And it's like, whoa. So that's what she wrote down later. "Surprise, the sun feels good. The warmth, the heat penetrates Jane's fuchsia turtleneck. The dark room chill crawls quickly away, afraid it might be destroyed in its opposite's progress. Can this be the same sun that in Thailand pushes everything away from itself? Shade, 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 my sweaty, overheated skin cries, that is in Bangkok. In Holden, I move leisurely from one sunny spot to the next, soaking in the penetrating warmth." This lady has a wonderful name. I don't know if I can do it justice. Her name is Borghild Gieselgeist. Gieselgeist. Borghild Gieselgeist. What Holden is. It's the listening, the sharing, the talking and caring, the tallness and majesty of trees reaching high, the glow of the sunshine, the blue of sky. Praise is our giving. Love is the living. We hear the voices of children, a sad cry or glad shout. The earth is their playground. On it they are skipping and bouncing around and about. We lift our hearts in thanks. Couples hold hands and stroll. Young folks alone find a friend. Olders speak freely and share gently their hope. We are together, a part of this place, learning and growing, watching and accepting, knowing the largeness and wonder of space. So those are some of the poems shared here. And I wanted to also share some thoughts that William Stafford has written in a couple of books about writing. I mentioned him before, he's probably my favorite poet. He's a very loved teacher as well, and has now passed away, but he's still around. We're passing him on here, in his thoughts. He has a famous quote that you may have heard of before. It's from his book, Writing the Australian Crawl. And it is, "A writer is not so much someone who has something to say as he is someone who has found a process that will bring about new things he would not have thought of if he had not started to say them. It's a very relaxed way of writing, but it's worked for many, many people since he's been around.
Would you read that again?
Okay. A writer is not so much someone who has something to say as he or she is someone who has found a process that will bring about new things he would not have thought of if he had not started to say them. And he wrote in You Must Revise Your Life, in art I find my way by means of all experience, not just those that have been extracted and called the tradition of art. And then the exploration of what the materials of life can yield to us and the discovery of what is implicit in human experience will work best for one who has turned outward with trust, with courage, and with a ready yielding to what time brings into view. The most impressive such experience I recall was on the banks of the Cimarron River in western Kansas, one mild summer evening, when sky, air, bird calls, and the setting sun combined to expand the universe for me and to give me the feeling of being sustained, cherished, included somehow in a great reverent story. And slant, chance, verbal experiences have approximated this, come to think of it. Passages of scripture, cadences in a friend's voice, habitual phrases in home conditions. The morning was dim, sure, and imperceptible, brightening the sky with yellow, gray, orange, and then the powerful sun. That encounter with the size and serenity of the earth and its neighbors in the sky has never left me. The earth was my home. I would never feel lost while it held me. Because my writing was an ongoing linking of the inner river of my life to the emergent realizations that daily experience brought, I was never without material. Ideally for me, poems are nothing special. They are just the language without any mistakes. Of course, that is the way I would like to talk. Ideally, every letter should have the same trance-like forward unfolding into the subject matter that a poem should have. I think poems are pieces of talk, savored and sustained. I would call them lucky talk. A poem is a lucky piece of talk. Letters are usually addressed to someone we are sympathetic with. It can be direct. It appeals to many common experiences, usually. I think a poem is like that. So I wanted to work with the third exercise that I brought, which is a kind of letter poem. It has to be my poem. I used an example of mine as a recent poem. It's not necessarily a very good poem, but it's something I could share as a way of describing a kind of letter poem or a poem that tells a story to somebody else. In this case, also finding out maybe something about myself at the same time. So I said, think of a true story from your own life that you find yourself telling people in conversation. People do that all the time. You know, I had a teacher, Nelson Bentley, at the University of Washington State, said that this was the stuff of poems. That's where I got the idea. But through your lifetime, you'll tell stories over and over again, you know, that have happened in your life. And they get better and better. It's like folk art, you know. They improve and along the way. And you tell them pretty much the same way each time because they have a punchline. Those are wonderful material for poems. And one way to do it in a longer session is to tell that story to the person next to you and then immediately write that story down. I think today I'd like to have you tell the story and just tell the story and then, you know, after class, if you have a chance to write it down, that would be good. And if the story affects you emotionally when you tell it, use that knowledge to add statement to the narrative so that it is not just an account of what happened, but it is as fully realized as you can make it. And that means that instead of just telling the action, you explain how you feel as you go along or felt. what that meant to you, what you learned from it. And then write a poem from the story with a title suggesting self-realization. This is something that happened to me very recently, and I was telling the story over the phone to my son who lives in Virginia, and I started to cry, and I thought, this is really not that important a story to make me cry, but it touched something in me, not that my purse was snatched, but that I had learned something about friendship and about...
Check, close the door.
Okay, about the ability of making friends, and you didn't think you could, or you don't know if you're a worthy kind of person ever, that a person wants to be your friend. Just the whole miracle of being the kind of person somebody would want to know. And being grateful for that. So I wrote it down after I talked to him on the phone, and then gave the poem to the person who had given me back my purse as a gift. And she received it very, very graciously, and I hope it was a way of explaining to her that I was wanting to be her friend, as well as thanking her. But this can go on, you know, beyond your own experience to how other people might relate to it who read the poem and think about their life, so that a poem from your own personal experience may seem unimportant to you, but it's really not, because other people learn from your experiences when you write. And I've always believed that we go to literature to learn how to live. We don't go for entertainment. If it's very great literature, if it's good literature, we go to learn how to live our lives, because we find out how other people were able to do that through literature. So I'll read this real quick, and then maybe we can start the process here. I might read another example too I brought. After a purse snatching led me to Jenny. At her door, she would see if it was really me in the photograph on my driver's license when I came to get the purse, would only open the pocket with my identifying cards. It was found by another stranger in the street and brought to my old apartment address. Jenny took responsibility, she explained, as usual. In exchange for a grocery bunch of yellow flowers I bought on the way with borrowed cash, she led me to my contained life, a silly blue pocket bag propped on her kitchen table. She took the succulents from my hand, this time with a frail but strong tug, after the wrenching pull as I walked home, someone running up behind me to a waiting car. This is what I was left without, proof of who I am. She liked the sunny flowers, more the need that brought me in to visit. She let me have the purse when I had finally lifted enough good glasses of peach wine to our long lives. Then she gave me this feeling of being able to be known, not involved with the violated papers and keys or missing money. Identification I wanted, friend. And this is a little poem I actually wrote to Michael. It's fun to write poems and about experiences you've had with another person and then put their name underneath, and that's a part of the poem. I grew up in Alaska, and this is an experience from my childhood. It was an ordinary experience, but hopefully it has deeper meaning in the poem than you might think just seeing children doing this activity. Calcium to Michael. There was not enough sunlight for our 9-year-old bones in the care at school of the territory of Alaska. Before sliding into our seats in the 2-grade classroom, the way we had just been sliding on our bottoms from side to side down the snow between spruce trees, we had to stand in line each day for a wafer at the water fountain, swallow a piece of the sun in a calcium pill. Sometimes we would keep the pills in our cheeks and pretend to swallow them as we gulp the water, secretly dislodging their solidness into our hands and hiding them in our pockets or using the chalky stuff for chalk. Harder to accept as caring than to fight dark days without it. We clenched in our teeth what was given to us in the shape of sunlight and held it from our tongues, as you and I some days reject love's small opportunities for strength when we could drink them down in our terms at the fountain. And I brought a book of William Stafford's poems after talking about him through his books about writing. This is a book of his poems, and it's in the library here, and I'll give it back finally after a week with me. Actually, 3 years ago, I came up and checked this out. 2 days to the year, I mean, to 3 years of when I've been here before. It's a very important book to me. You can see from his poems, he talks about ordinary things in his poems, like he was suggesting. But this is just a story, really, about his father, what his father told him, and then he passed it on to us and then made statements out of the knowledge. Father's voice. No need to get home early. The car can see in the dark. He wanted me to be rich the only way we could, easy with what we had. And always that was his gift, given, easy gift. A wind that keeps on blowing for flowers or birds wherever I look. World, I am your slow guest, one of the common things that move in the sun and have close, reliable friends in the earth, in the air, in the rock. And this is just an ordinary event. He wrote down, this is only for telling a story, but made statements at the end that gave it its meaning. Things that happen. Sometimes before great events, a person will try, disguised at his best, not to be a clown. He feels a great event is coming, bowed down, and I, always looking for something anyway, always bow down. Once, later than dawn, but early, before the lines of the calendar fell, one of those events turned an unseen corner and came near, near, sounding before it, something the opposite from a leper's bell. We were back of three mountains called Sisters along the Green Lakes Trail and had crossed a ridge when that one little puff of air touched us, hardly felt at all. That was the greatest event that day. It righted all wrong. I remember it. The way the dust moved there. Something had come out of the ground and moved calmly along. No one was ahead of us, no one in all that moon-like land. Oh, I thought, how hard the world has tried with its wind, its miles, its blundering, stumbling days, again and again, to find my hand. So that I want to go on to what you might out loud write down on paper as far as an ordinary event, and kind of just as you go along, pause and think of statements that would add to the story if it were a poem, statements about how you felt about it, what you learned from it. This is going to be a rough draft, obviously. Oral rough draft, but you can contribute something.
So you want a little story?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to tell you about this hike we did yesterday with it was my husband and me and then our son and his wife and three little children. But mostly about the 6-year-old Bailey, who is anxious about lots of things. And so as soon as we started on the trail, she was worried that we would get lost. And we went on this trail that they're making, which we really shouldn't have gone on, so it was kind of rough, and we weren't quite sure what we were doing. And what did these signs say about blasting, and what did that mean? And so all the time I'm thinking about being reassuring to her. And then Grandpa went kind of off the trail to find the lower trail, and then she's worried about him getting lost, and she's calling out to him. And then she kept saying, you know, is it worth it to see this falls when we get there? And so I said, oh yeah, it'd be worth it. So, and then there was a lizard. We thought it was a snake, and she wanted to see it. And she was eager to see that, and just scooted into the woods. You know. So I was trying to reassure her, you know, about this trail. Well, when we get to the falls, she's just thrilled with this, of course. And we went up a little higher, and there's this long log you can walk on. And on one side, further up, I could see it would be water if she fell off. And so now I'm beginning to be frightened, and she wanted to just zoom up this log. And I can't do that. I can't walk on logs. First, I said, your mom or dad has to be here. Well, Grandpa came and did it with her. But here she was now. She wasn't afraid of this at all. She wanted to do this and go further up. And, you know, another time she was just, well, then I was the one who was afraid. Well, I just kind of delight in
her. I'm seeing that, like the rhythm that we're talking about in life, you know, how you, children will have that lack of fear.
She goes between being very anxious and pretty brave.
Yeah.
And now, another thing was that on the train coming, she was relating to us very well. Well, now she's found friends with her each year. Just since yesterday. So you know, now I'm a lot less important. She's looking at this friend.
Yeah. It occurs to me you could praise her by writing that story down as a poem, you know, and show her what she was able to do after her fear. Mm-hmm. Just in her own action.
Yeah.
What she was able to accomplish. One of the great things to me about writing poems is you give them to people, you know, and they really like it, usually, you know, they may not act like it, but they do.
Especially if it's about them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. Okay.
Oh, I think I'll pass.
Want to come back, to come back to you?
It's hard to think of the story right off the bat. This was just...
You said that you have been in a journal writing workshop. Can you remember some things that you want to share some advice from that for us?
Well, I enjoyed it immensely, and I surprised myself at some of the things that I wrote. But I have kept a diary for 60 years, probably.
Wow.
And the last few years, it's just been in one of these little five-year diary books. And I decided that there's more to a day's activity than four little lines. So I've graduated now to a 8x12 spiral notebook and elaborating on different things, you know. And about 8 years ago, I compiled my diaries and made a little book for each one of my children and gave it to them.
Yeah.
Things that had happened since 1940.
Mm, that's great.
And I was telling my journal teacher that the book that I wrote, it seemed, we were talking about how you remember the good things that have happened, but the things that weren't so good, you're a little hesitant to mention and so on and so forth. And I said, the book that I wrote, most of the things were good, but I did tell how we got through the things that weren't so good. But since I wrote that, so many changes have happened within my family's life that I think I should write another one, and it won't be very good. That's how I would handle the whole life,
the good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I know when I was real young, I kept a diary, which I don't have anymore, which I wish I did. That probably just told, you know, like a teenager would, just the things that happened to me that were good. I didn't probably ever talk about the sad things. Well,
my problem is that I would just say, maybe I had a little fight with a friend. You know, this is as a child. But I would never elaborate on that. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never tell how I felt.
Because you were afraid someone would read it?
Or anything. No, I just didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult, I think, for me to express how I feel, except being angry or, you know, something like that.
You think maturing has something to do with that, that you accept?
But I'm pretty mature.
Well, I think as I'm getting older, I accept more, you know, I don't think that everything has to be ideal or you know, I can't share or face something that's less than wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think, I think for me, I do diary journaling too. I can write some things that I can't say to anybody, mm-hmm. feeling wise.
Yeah, I can too.
And I think someday somebody is probably going to read this and maybe I would rather they didn't in a way, but then I think if it's after I'm gone, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it isn't going to be awful stuff, it's just what is her feelings.
My daughter and I met a friend and her daughter yesterday for lunch between Bellingham and Seattle. And this friend and I have been friends for over 60 years. And her daughter wanted to know how the secret to keeping friendships like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, don't you have friends that you have had for many, many years? And she said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think the secret is letter writing.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Which because is, we've always been apart, but we've always corresponded.
And not too many people do that anymore, do they?
Well, I was thinking, I have a high school friend who, I mean, we went to high school in the 50s, who I still write to, and that's why we're still friends. Otherwise, we would have lost track, I'm sure. But we share things that we might not, if we were together.
Yeah. And you wouldn't share them over the telephone.
No.
And everybody telephones now, or else faxes, or, you know.
Yeah.
So, I thought that was interesting.
That is. Well, if you were to write a poem explaining how to them what you just told us, you know, that would be a wonderful source.
About letters.
Or a letter. Yeah.
Letters.
But, you know, how, well, a letter is a kind of poem. Mm-hmm. A poem is a kind of letter, but, you know, advice, or not advice exactly, but wisdom about how to keep a friend, or, you know, the ups and downs of keeping a friend that you can pass on.
Mm-hmm. My mother would always write a letter to me every week. I have always written to my children every week. Now my sister writes to me every week. You know, and it's just a pattern. Every Sunday I write letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's beautiful about writing a letter is that you have someone on the other end, which when you write poetry and bring it to a workshop, you have someone on the other end too, if you give it to someone, but that's what we need is that connection. And you have a particular person you're writing to that way. You can do that when you write a poem too, have a person in mind. Like when I wrote that poem to Michael, I had him in mind, I was speaking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts a focus on what you're thinking.
But I'm very interested in these poems because, I think you said they are sort of letters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, poems always rhyme. I mean, that was the thing that was always in my head. If you write a poem, you make it rhyme.
Well, we were talking about that when we first here, that it can still rhyme in a contemporary poem. A poem very often rhymes internally, inside the lines. The music's still there, but it's just not done by outside.
There was one poem I wrote, read, that had internal, beautiful internal lines.
Was that a Stafford poem?
No, the student.
Oh.
The young person.
Uh-huh, Chrissy?
Yeah, she had internal rhyming in her poem.
Oh, a few lines.
Yeah, you know, right inside the line. I thought it was really good.
So it's still with us. I mean, we still need that kind of beauty in our poetry today. And it's still with us. It's just not as, it's not as direct or it's not as noticeable.
Mm-hmm. So what really is the difference between writing in prose and poetry? I mean, it's not rhyming, but it's something else.
Well, it's closer to your emotions, usually.
Yeah.
It's a moment in time where you're expressing something using your emotions, whereas if you tell a story, you have a longer time maybe to explain your emotions. But that's why statement is very important, because you can condense down how you're feeling. To me, it's a different art form than writing.
You leave some gaps left in the imagination. Because I have written some things that I call poems, they're not prose, and they don't rhyme. It's just writing down some thoughts, and it does leave some, it's not like you're explaining every detail.
Uh-huh.
So they're supposed to kind of catch on.
Yeah, well, Stafford used to say that his definition of a poem was that it was listened to or read in a certain kind of attention. It's a heightened awareness attention that you bring to a poem that you can also bring to a story, but poetry seems to create the same kind of mood that music does. It puts you in a mood or a state of awareness that's a heightened state of awareness. It's kind of an amusing sort of mood where you're reflecting and thinking the same. I get that feeling listening to music, the same kind of feeling. I don't get that from hearing a short story read. I was listening to a short story read last night, and it's a different kind of listening. You're seeing the images move, and you're seeing the plot and the characters, but you're not in that transcended mood of listening that music and poetry.
It doesn't have to have any particular meter or rhythm or length of lines. And it seems like in school we used to have that.
Yeah.
Well, those things are still valuable in that they're a beautiful part of our culture, but just that people today don't seem to be writing in form. They're writing more nicely.
What was that thing we talked about that? You had a quote from someone about rhyme verse versus free verse. Somebody brought that question up.
Well, there's a famous one from Robert Frost that writing free verse is like playing tennis with a net down, but it's still the same game. It's just that you don't.
No, but there was one you had that was supportive and that a teacher told you about. I've forgotten who it was.
Hmm. Well, I had a teacher, Theodore Recky, who used to teach us form because it was a way to learn. Like you learn scales or you learn classical music by learning the very basis of the art and then going and loosening it up. Contemporary poetry just happens to be looser. Maybe we'll go back to more formal structure, but like I went down to Narnia and this little girl popped up and said, oh, I have a poem. And it wasn't what the rest of the children were doing. This was with the lions that ages 6 to 10, and she had it evidently somewhere, and she knew it to recite. It was obviously wrote right then, but she was very proud of the fact that it rhymed. She'd been taught that poetry should rhyme. And yet what I was trying to show the children is it didn't have to rhyme. But those, you know, those are things that we still carry with us, and there it's very much an amalgamation of the two in the art. So can or cannot, can or doesn't have to rhyme. I grew up loving hymns as a child. When I was brought to church, I don't think I went to Sunday school. Maybe that was why my dad took him with me up into the regular service. So I used to entertain myself by reading the hymnal. And I love the rhyming, you know, the verses of hymns. Mm-hmm. So I've always loved
that's a
the beauty of language.
Really, wasn't that? You know.
And I started writing in form because I'm 56 years old, and when I went to school, that's what we did, we wrote in form. So it's been a growth process for me to do it a different way. I can't remember the quote you're talking about.
Yeah, I can't either, except something about that the rhymed verse has gotten to such elevated heights that maybe they, people should contribute in free verse, you know, rather than trying to mesh with the grid old, or I don't
like trying to write like Bach, or
yeah,
maybe it's a thing of the time just changes things.
See, if I think I have to do it, you know, with that kind of form, that's gonna, but that would discourage me.
Yes, yes.
I'd have to work too hard, you know, just.
I think that's a major stopping point for a lot of people. It freed me. I would have never, it would have never occurred to me to write.
Even rhyming is fun, but
yeah,
you
me
have
that's
to work
not,
on rhyming. It's too hard.
That's the only way I've ever written it.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to
yes,
talk about
you're
a story?
Next.
Well, I was in Europe. On a long vacation by myself before I came here, and part of the trip I spent traveling on a bicycle. I had all my gear packed on a bicycle.
Were you in Holland?
No, I was in Germany in this case. And Holland is the first place we think of people in our generation because that's where the bicycle paths are. But Germany's actually a wonderful place to tour. A lot of maps and so on, guides and so on. And I've always been fascinated by solo adventures, you know, like sailing solo and solo bicycling. I've met a number of middle-aged people that have done this sort of thing, so I got interested in doing that. Plus the pace of travel, I love train travel, you know, European trains are wonderful, but there's something about traveling by bicycle which is real special. It slows down how much you have to absorb, and you're still almost as free as you are in the car. So anyway, to make a long story short, I had some adventures which hadn't been exactly positive with my bicycle. Fallen down and bent some stuff up and hurt myself. And I decided I would, after this, I would take another journey despite this fact, you know, that I already knew that things could be dangerous. And I, on the first day, what turned out to be a 5-day journey through northern Germany, in it's called a heath. I spent the first night at a relative that I knew, and spent the night there. She was out of town, and I spent the half the day sightseeing, and then I loaded my bicycle up with a lot of misgivings. You know, the weather was sort of, you know, inclining toward rain, and I thought, well, okay, I'll go on this trip, but you know. And the first thing was I stopped and felt really kind of weak, you know, it was hot and starting to rain and blow, and the dust would come back. already had this feeling of loneliness that you get sometimes, you know, when you're starting something new and you're not totally sure, you don't know. It's a strange country, you know, and I saw a little kid coming by looking at me curiously. I said, the way my bike was loaded, anybody in Germany could tell that I wasn't from Germany. You know, we load our bikes differently when we go touring. And so I stopped and had, you know, a piece of candy bar and some water, and I felt a little better. And then I got to the next town, and that was more reassuring, you know. And then finally, beyond that town, it was got very lonely. You know, I was just by myself on this road. Then I heard this crashing in the bushes, and I remembered that I had read in my guide that this was a military training area. And this crashing continued, and I could hear the artillery fire, you know, and I was born in Germany myself. And I'd heard the same guns at the end of the war, you know, when the tanks were rolling in to capture our town. In that case, they were French tanks. And these were German tanks, it turned out. And then, so this is sort of the beginning of the story. And the moment of truth was when my room and the road where the tanks were traveling converged, and I had to sit there while they all passed by in long columns, and they had the black German cross on it, and these people, you know, the soldiers are all dirty from top to toe and looking at me on my bike, and I felt very fragile, you know, just this little bike, a lot of wind and dust, and these huge columns of tanks rolling by. And the next spot for me was to pedal down this road, not knowing if there was another column of tanks coming up the road, you know, and I was left alone with all my memories of World War II, you know, all the tanks and the guns and the Black Cross and the helmets and the camouflage, you know. Actually, it was dirt, somebody told me there. You get just plain dirty, you know, and the noise, you know, and the rumbling, and then the crashing in the forest. The trees would be, you know, crashing down before the tanks. And here I was on this little bike, this very quiet little bike, you know. And then the tanks went away, and I was left on this road. Nobody in sight. Every once in a while somebody would pass 60 or 70 miles. Germans drive very fast. 70 miles an hour, somebody. One little bike and the wind and this long road, rolling road, and not knowing where the next tank was coming from. And it got to be really painful after all. And then finally I got away from the military, and then in the guide it said cobblestones, you know, cobblestone, that doesn't sound too good. And then I was in the cobblestones, you know, and it's the same kind of thing, except that now I was being beaten around on the cobblestones, you know, and the car still passed me on this cobblestone, except they were not the kind of cobblestones that we like to think of. They were smooth and tightly fitted together, so you could actually ride on them. So that was my first day of that trip, and it got better and better after that. But I still remember this very vulnerable moment, you know, out there, sitting with these tanks and this little metal thing, you know, just on my bike and not really knowing, you know, what would happen next.
It makes me think of what we say about a moment in time, because I can see the poem and that story being the feeling of all the memories coming up.
The memories,
you know,
that it brought back for you.
But also the vulnerability that you feel. You know, if I'd been a young person, probably I wouldn't have felt so
vulnerable. Or if there'd been anybody else around.
No bicyclists. Normally you have lots of bicyclists. And it was just the way she'd chosen the route. I feel like writing her, I probably will write her a letter. There's another way to do this route. So you go from one hostel to another one.
And not through the military, it's all right.
Well, her choice was to go through what used to be a concentration camp, Belsen, which is a notorious concentration camp, and I didn't want to go that way, so I chose the other way, you know, that I saw on the map. So which evil do you choose, you know?
That's what travelers can find, too, or experiences that people living in the area would consider ordinary events, but to a traveler, those ordinary events are much more meaningful.
Yeah, I got to the next town, and I still heard the artillery fire, and I asked someone, is this thunder or artillery fire? And they just shook their head. And I told them my story, and I just told you, and they just said, yeah, this is pretty bad in there. You don't want to go through this.
Well, thank you.
Oh, good. We're supposed to be through on the tape, but we can continue longer. We can be through on the tape minister. It's been an hour, so thank you very much. But we can continue talking.
I didn't know what to expect.
Interesting.
Did you have something?
Where are you from?
I'm from Seattle. I'm originally from Alaska, but I live in Seattle.
You live in Seattle.
Did you have something you wanted to add as far as the story?
So I was just thinking about my poem.
Oh. Your poem?
You mean one you have written or one you're going to write?
One that
Well, I was going to suggest that I'm leaving tomorrow, but if you wanted to show me anything, I'd, you know, be tickled pink, as I say. So.
Well.
Yeah, I might do something on that one. I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, I bet you could.
I've got a book of Richard Hugo, and you might be interested in that, because he has a whole section of letter poems that he wrote, and he has them published in there, and maybe you'd be interested in
that. Did he actually send to people then?
Yeah, he actually sends them to people.
Missoula.
You know, there are some of them are quite famous too.
Oh,
but
who is
Letter
it?
To So and So, Richard Hugo.
Hugo.
And it's called
32 Letters and 4 Dreams or something like that.
Yeah, but that's,
well, that's
book
the book
is making
yeah.
certain it goes on. That's the title of his selected poems. That's the collection.
But he did publish them in a smaller collection called 32 Letters. And
yeah.
32 Letters is the name of this
or something. Uh-huh.
If I see you at dinner, I'll give it to you.
He signed each one of them like, you know, Love Dick or, you know, Later Dick or, you know, they're real letters. And he started that for him, really. And people started copying him then.
Yeah. No, I can show it to you now, actually. I just have to go to my room. Which lodge are you in?
2.
I'm in 2.
Are you? What room are you?
15.
We're 19. We're neighbors.
Yeah. You can look at it. It's kind of interesting. He just does what I have a hard time doing is, you know, the play on words makes it so interesting.
Yeah, that's what I like too, and I don't do it, you know, but I'd like to be able to.
Yeah.
But then the people you wrote to must have, I mean, sometimes you could write something and the person receiving it wouldn't get it, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking too that he probably said some rather personal things about those people in the poems and then later.
They
would have to have given it permission.
Hopefully.